This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In his State of the Union address this year, President Obama announced what he called a cancer moonshot. And he said Vice President Joe Biden would be in charge of the effort.
So tonight I'm announcing a new national effort to get it done. And because he's gone to the mat for all of us on so many issues over the past 40 years, I'm putting Joe in charge of mission control. For the loved ones we've all lost, for the families that we can still save, let's make America the country that cures cancer once and for all. What do you say, Joe? Let's make it happen.
Obama's directive would pump more money into research for treatments and cures for cancer and would up the visibility of the disease, the second leading cause of death in America. There are more than 200 different types of cancer. Today on the program, we're going to talk with two doctors in our region who are looking into the future and trying to develop effective treatments for patients with cancer. We'll start with Dr. Deborah Leonard. She's chair of the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at the University of Vermont's College of Medicine. Dr. Leonard, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks, Jane. It's good to be here.
What did you think when you first heard President Obama say that this was going to be his moonshot, finding a cure for cancer?
I was very excited. There had been an effort to cure cancer in the past, and likening it to the moonshot was very relevant to me. I grew up in the era of putting a man on the moon, and I understand all the things that spun off from that were unanticipated, and I expect that this will do the same type of good for cancer patients.
The idea that we can cure cancer, is that really possible? Finding, you know, a cure or many cures, but this idea that we're going to somehow cure cancer and be rid of it.
Well, currently we have made advances that actually do cure certain types of cancer. Certain types of Hodgkin's lymphoma are successfully cured. Childhood leukemias, some of them can be successfully cured. Testicular cancer can be cured. But most cancers can be quite aggressive. And I think another model to think about rather than curing is managing more like a chronic disease. So if you think about HIV, I trained in medical school when there was the HIV epidemic, and young men were dying left and right, and it was a horrible time. Now, HIV is a chronic disease that you manage with combinations of drugs. And so by looking at the cancer drivers, what is making the cancer cells grow faster or not die as fast as their normal counterparts, we can use combinations of very targeted therapies to target the specific growth of that cell and make it go away for the most part. Some residual cells may remain that weren't actually killed by the drugs that we gave. They might come back, but we will look at those cells and see what are their drivers. And so we turn it more into a chronic disease that is managed over time, even if we don't now know how to cure certain types of cancer.
So like HIV, AIDS, or diabetes, you can see a future where somebody says, I was diagnosed with cancer, this form of cancer at age 40, and then I lived with it till age 80, managing it?
Yes, we actually do that with some types of cancer today. And so cures are ideal, and that's what we would like to shoot for. But also being able to manage the disease and give people longer, productive lives is also a great outcome with cancer.
I want to invite our listeners into this conversation. We are talking about some of the cutting-edge research being done in our region when it comes to cancer treatment and cancer prevention and cancer cures in some cases. And if you have something you'd like to share, maybe you yourself have an experience or you have a question, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Dr. Deborah Leonard, you work at the UVM Medical Center. Can you talk a little bit about the Cancer Center at UVM and put the research being done there into the context of this national conversation about cancer treatment?
Sure. At the UVM Cancer Center, we focus on research, clinical care, and teaching and education in general about cancer. The research that we do is all along what we call the translational highway. So from basic mechanisms of cancer to when we identify those basic mechanisms that are causing a cancer and the growth of the cells, that actually creates the opportunity to target that pathway or that mechanism with a drug. So we have people working on developing drugs targeted, usually in combination with pharmaceutical companies or biotech companies, and then moving that through the clinical trials of phase one clinical trials that just look at whether that drug is safe, and then begin to look at effectiveness in phase two and three clinical trials. So we have that entire continuum. We, in clinical care, we actually create teams across the clinical and research spectrum. So we have what we call transdisciplinary teams in 12 different cancer types of cancer. And that brings together the individuals who are caring for patients with that disease, because sometimes they make observations in patients that are highly informative to drive the research. And so we have researchers, clinicians, educators on these transdisciplinary teams. And then the University of Vermont Cancer Center also provides educational forums for patients, for providers. Last year, I spoke at the breast cancer conference in the fall related to some of the genomic work that I am doing.
Is that typical, the way you describe the Cancer Center at UVM, for how research hospitals work around the country on cancer research?
Yes. I think more and more cancer centers are moving to transdisciplinary teams. I think one of the unique things here in Vermont, and I've been at several other academic medical centers, is everyone knows everyone. There is great patient participation. There is an environment here in Vermont that makes the work that we do just so much easier and exciting. We don't have the silos and the politics that I have observed at other academic medical centers, not to badmouth them, but to say we're doing great things here that sometimes can't be done elsewhere.
When it comes to the national picture and the national landscape, and then I want to get into your specific research, but help me understand if it's a system where, you know, different cancer centers are working on a specific type of cancer or a specific mode of treatment, and somebody else somewhere else, another team, is doing a different thing? Or is everybody sort of working on everything, or, you know, whatever their particular specialty is, all over the country? You know, is it like the Cleveland Clinic has certain specialties, UVM Medical Center has certain specialties, the Dartmouth College of Medicine has certain specialties, and you all then use what the others find, or is it more haphazard?
No, there is a lot of information sharing and a lot of collaboration and cooperation, not just at UVM, but across the country. So there are regional oncology groups that cooperate to translate new drugs and basic science findings into the clinical trials environment. So the cancer oncology groups, usually there are many academic medical centers and even community hospitals that are participating in cooperative clinical trials. The basic science research, you will have centers of excellence in different ways of looking at cancer. So I actually, in my department, have a group that does redox biology and pathology research. So what is that? There are oxidative processes, and you've heard probably of free radicals that are bad and can cause tissue damage. And we have systems in our body that control those, but if they're not properly controlled, they can result in things like cancer. And so one of a group of my investigators have found a marker that is either totally on or totally off in lung cancer. And so we're trying to understand what are the differences, and would there be differences in the way those cancers respond? This is work that Yvonne Janssen-Heiniger is doing in my department.
We're talking with Dr. Deborah Leonard. She's chair of the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at the University of Vermont's College of Medicine. And if you have a question for her, again, our number is 1-800 639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a question from Sarah who says, why does it seem like cancer is everywhere these days? I feel like every other day I'm hearing about someone who's just found out they have cancer. Is there evidence that it's dramatically on the rise right now?
The first thought that comes to mind is, how old is Sarah? Because except for childhood and early childhood cancers or infant and early childhood cancers, there are cancer is much more of an older person disease. And older, I guess I'm in that age range already, but from 40s and 50s on. And so I think there's a rising awareness. Some cancers actually are decreasing in incidence because of like cervical cancer for women has decreased because of the screening and then because of HPV vaccines. But others are increasing. So that varies by cancer type, but also the incidence varies by age. And so as you get older, your risk of cancer does increase.
And perhaps more contemporaries who you know who are getting cancer diagnoses.
Yes. Now watch, Sarah will be 20 years old, but I don't know.
Dr. Leonard, can you talk about the work that you're doing? You're looking at genomic tests and how you can use a person's particular genome to personalize treatments for them when they get cancer. Explain what that means.
So I am a molecular pathologist and have been practicing for 24 years now, using testing methods to study the genetic material to provide diagnoses in cancer, but also inherited disorders in infectious diseases, other areas. So for cancer, cancers develop because there are changes in the genetic material in those cells. Sometimes the differences in the cancer cells are due to inherited changes. So there's Lynch syndrome, BRCA1 and 2 that causes breast cancer. Those can be inherited cancer risks. But most cancers are developed just because things go haywire. That's not a very technical term. But in the cells, as the cells are dividing, some of the genetic material changes. And it changes in a way that causes those cells to grow faster, usually, or not die as fast so that they accumulate more. There are different ways that, that cancers accumulate. Many of them grow faster. And so what we do is to look at the cancer cells using the testing methods that we have called genomic testing, using a methodology called next-generation sequencing. And our first test that we've developed is for solid tumors. So that's breast cancer, colon cancer, anything that's not a blood malignancy or blood cancer. And there are 29 genes that can predict response in different cancer types to what are called targeted therapies. So targeted therapies are treatments that actually work on a specific pathway or mechanism that's causing the cells to grow too fast and blocks that pathway. So the cells either stop growing or die. And so it's very important to know that we are using these targeted treatments in patients who have the mutations or changes in their cancer cells that predict that they will respond. Because one example, there is a gene called EGFR. It stands for epidermal growth factor receptor. So you can see why we call it EGFR. And if there are changes in EGFR, it will cause the cells to grow faster because they constantly have a signal that says grow, grow, grow. And there are inhibitors of that signal that block that signaling pathway and stop the cells from growing. But what researchers in clinical trials have found is if you give that targeted therapy to patients with a lung cancer that has an EGFR change or mutation, the patients do much better. But if you give that targeted therapy to patients who don't have an EGFR mutation or change, they actually do worse than traditional therapy, chemotherapy that kills any kind of dividing cell. So it's very important to use these targeted therapies in the correct way. And that's what we are working on in the clinical care of cancer patients. Many medical centers are doing this, But we are actually asking a question that not many medical centers are asking, which is, does this bring value to cancer care? And so does this improve patient outcomes overall? And does it improve the cost effectiveness overall of cancer care here in Vermont?
Because the idea would be if you may be spending more on the tests that determine whether this person has the mutation, but then if you can target the treatment, they may be treated either more easily or more effectively or more quickly, which would lead to a reduction in the overall cost of the treatment. Is
exactly.
that the cost benefit that you're doing?
Exactly. Or we're not spending the cost, because the targeted therapies are more expensive, we're not spending that cost on someone who is not likely to respond.
And you're in the middle of that now. Have you found anything yet?
Actually, I signed up my first three cases just a couple weeks back, and two of them had no variants that would give targeted therapy. But actually, one of them did have a mutation that would predict a response exactly to these they're called tyrosine kinase inhibitors, TKIs. But there are three generations of TKIs, and there was recent literature or research done in 2015 that I found in the literature that basically predicted that for a certain kind of EGFR mutation, because they happen in different regions of this protein or gene, there's likely that a greater likelihood for patients to respond to the second generation TKIs rather than the first or the third. And so traditionally we would start with first generation, but in this patient, the oncologist discussed the findings and decided that they would start with a second generation TKI. So it was very exciting.
So do you envision a future where anybody with a cancer diagnosis, or presumably other kinds of diagnoses as well, would have a full, you know, lab test of their genetic makeup to figure out exactly what's going on, and that we'd each get very individualized treatment for whatever cancer type we have?
Well, that's the direction we're moving. So we're starting with cancer care, solid tumors, then blood cancers, and then this inherited cancer risk testing. Those will be three separate tests. And then we're going to develop a pharmacogenomic test, because different people respond to drugs and need different doses. And very often we are doing this generically rather than targeted for individuals in individuals' genetic makeup. And then we will likely be moving to do genome sequencing of the entire genetic material of individual patients to look at what their disease risks are, not only of cancer, but of other kinds of diseases as well.
What happens if what you discover is that in terms of treatment, it is more effective, but in terms of cost, it's also more expensive?
Then we will have to decide whether that extra cost is worth the better outcomes for our patients. And so part of the cost equation and the outcomes equation is also looking at the quality of life for patients. Sometimes it's very hard to put a price tag on that. And if it's within reason, then that will, the improved quality of life will tip the balance to continuing to do this.
That's Dr. Deborah Leonard. She's chair of the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at the University of Vermont's College of Medicine. And again, she's been working on genomic tests to develop how personalized treatments can get for cancer patients. Thank you very much for telling us about your research and the research being done at the UVM Cancer Center.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
We're talking about some of the innovations in cancer research being done in our region. Coming up, we'll be talking with a Dartmouth doctor who's looking at how plant virus particles can trigger an immune system reaction against tumors. If you'd like to share a question or an experience, give us a call. 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're looking at advances in cancer research and some of the work that's being done to address challenges in treatments and cures that could help future cancer patients. If you have some research you'd like to share, or a question, or your own experience, you can call 1-800-639-2211. 1-800-639-2211. That number is 1-800-639-2211. Or you can always post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We're joined now by Dr. Stephen Fiering. Dr. Fiering is a professor of microbiology, immunology, and genetics at Dartmouth College's Geisel School of Medicine. Dr. Fiering, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Jane. It's a pleasure to join you and your listeners.
Well, we're really happy to have you. And I would love for you to start, again, by sort of putting in context the work being done at Dartmouth broadly, and then we can get into some of your really interesting research.
Well, I think that Dr. Leonard's discussion of the work at University of Vermont Cancer Center is very reflective of what's going on at the Norris Cotton Cancer Center, which is the name for the cancer center at Dartmouth. In that there's a broad array of efforts across this spectrum of cancers and trying to treat them clinically, improve the outcome. I think some of the things that in particular Dartmouth is strong in, one of which we'll talk about today in my research, which is the ideas of using the immune system to as a means of treating cancer, the patient's own immune system. I think that we are particularly strong in that. And I think another area we are particularly strong in is what is called sort of population studies, the epidemiology of who is getting cancer, where are the hotspots for cancer, and studies of outcomes. As Dr. Leonard was talking about, it's very important to try to understand what sort of therapies are working best for what type of people. And the Norris Cotton Cancer Center is a leader in that area. And unlike Dr. Leonard, who's a physician, I'm a PhD. I'm not a physician. And so I'm less involved in the clinical care of the cancer patients, but there's definitely groups that are organized around different types of cancers, and they include the researchers and they include clinicians of various sorts. They work together as teams to try to accomplish the best outcome for the patient.
Let's go to one of our calls. Gene is on the line from Verscher. Hi, Gene. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I'm calling, and it sounds like what you're talking about right now. My question really was, is there someone doing demographic studies or data or collecting data on communities and areas within the state or within the country that's available to the public to know what kind of cancers are prevalent to the area and you know what's going on in the bigger picture, I suppose.
Gene, thanks for the call. Stephen Fiering?
Gene, I think that you're asking the wrong person is the reality of the situation. And although I would answer yes, I'm sure there is. And I know that there's a lot of effort that's going on at the Norris Cotton Cancer Center with certain types of environmental exposures. One example would be arsenic in drinking water. And but I don't really have a source of where to find that sort of information. My expectation is it's out there.
But to Gene's question, you were saying that at the Norris Cotton Cancer Center that there is a lot of work that's looking at populations or demographics and trying to get a better sense of how cancer acts in certain different populations, right?
Yeah, there definitely is. It's definitely a strength of the Norris Cotton Cancer Center, but it's not a strength of me. It's not one of my strengths.
Well, let's move to your strengths. And I would love for you to explain a little bit about what you're doing specifically and what you're thinking and looking at.
Well, I think that what we're looking at is broadly termed immunotherapy, using the immune system to try to fight the patient's cancer, the patient's own immune system. And I'm very excited about it. There's a lot of reasons to be excited about it. And I think that it's adding a very significant, really new idea. So traditionally, we've had surgery and radiation and various types of chemotherapy. And those have been the tools that clinicians have had for trying to treat cancer. I think Dr. Leonard was very clear and eloquent in describing the ideas of the new targeted chemotherapies. So the new drugs that are not just simply able to kill rapidly dividing cells, but are targeting pathways. And those are all rapidly developing and I think improving outcomes across the spectrum of cancers, but I think a completely new avenue is immunotherapy. And so for the people listening, I want them to have a few concepts that I think form the foundation of the ideas that would then make immunotherapy something that could be more easily understood. And the first concept is that the immune system recognizes cancers and attempts to attack them. And that's a very important point, and it's something that's literally been debated for over 100 years. Since the beginning of the 1900s, this debate has gone on. And now it's clearly settled that in virtually every situation where it's been looked at, we can recognize that there has been an immune response against the cancer. So then the question is, well, why do we get cancer? I think the first comment would be that if that immune response wasn't there, we would probably get cancer a lot more often. But it's getting removed when it's still microscopic, undetectable, and the immune system took care of it. But then sometimes it doesn't work. And I think it's important to try to understand why it doesn't work. And there's also a very clear answer for that now. And the answer is that the tumor itself, the cancer, manifests immunosuppressive mechanisms. The immune system is a constant balance between activation and suppression. If the immune system gets overactive, that's going to cause a lot of problems. We have a lot of known autoimmune diseases. If the immune system is not activating when it should, that causes problems. And there's myriads of various signals being passed around between the tissues and the immune cells of various sorts that determine that balance. And the cancers that become clinically issues, things that the doctors have diagnosed and people recognize as a problem, they are able to suppress the immune system. They are able to protect themselves. So that's the second important point. The immune system recognizes the cancer, but the cancer is protecting itself. So then the third point is that, okay, if we're going to get the immune system to successfully treat the cancer, then we have to have ways to shift the immune system so that it's able to successfully overcome that immunosuppression and effectively eliminate the cancer.
So my cancer, the cancer that I have in my body, might be putting a block up for my immune system. So my immune system can't fight it. And what you're saying is you need to find a way in or a workaround so that my immune system can do the work to actually fight that cancer.
Yes, that's it exactly, Jane.
And that was three, and then you had a fourth. Fourth concept.
No, I don't think I had a fourth.
Good.
Actually, I
okay.
think I was on three.
So
now we get into different layers of how the suppression can be reversed.
Yeah, and tell me what you're doing on that.
So what we're doing is a relatively it's an easy idea to understand. And the first concept, we already discussed how the tumor is able to immunosuppress the immune system, and most of that effect is local. So that when the immune cells that are searching out and they recognize that they should attack this cancer, when they approach the tumor, they get signals from the tumor and from the cells that the tumor has recruited that no, there's no problem here. Just relax. Nothing exciting is happening, essentially.
All's well.
Right? They suppress.
Mm-hmm.
And so our ideas are, if you can put things directly into a tumor that's been recognized and change that environment so that instead of the immune cells getting a signal like all is well, you get a signal like, this is very dangerous. You need to wake up. You need to do your job. Then you could get a response against that tumor that you've directly treated. You've just injected something right into that tumor to make it clearly recognizable by the immune system. And that's good, and that's part of what we're interested in doing. But we already have a fair number of ways with surgery and radiation of treating a recognized local tumor, let's say a primary tumor, mm-hmm. a breast tumor or something like that. What we're really interested in doing, though, is getting that successful immune response at the treated tumor to then spread throughout the body and to be able to recognize and effectively eliminate tumors that we do not know are there, metastatic tumors that the clinicians probably don't even know exist but are worried about. And so that's the approach that we're taking. And the kind of phrase that could be used is in situ vaccination, where the idea is you're trying to, just like we try to vaccinate the immune system so it recognizes and eliminates pathogens, we're trying to vaccinate the immune system so it recognizes and is able to eliminate cancer.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you, why is this approach better than, say, blasting the tumor or cutting it out? But it sounds like what you're saying is because, you know, you can get this cancer that metastasizes throughout your body or have it show up again in a different place, or tumors that just aren't even noticeable yet that are forming. And this approach would essentially, as you said, immunize the person against those in the future, or trigger that immune response to attack any future tumors.
Yeah, that's it exactly. And I think that we have to think in terms of not either or, but all of the above. And so, for instance, the way that we would propose to use this would be a patient gets diagnosed with a particular type of cancer, and there's usually a period between the diagnosis and, let's say, there's going to be surgery, in which not a lot is going on. They're just, the surgery scheduled, it's going to happen. And we think that the potential of doing something like manipulating the tumor to make it more recognizable by the immune system in that period could have some effect on early stage metastatic disease that hasn't been detected. And then the surgery is coming along and it's going to get scheduled, and it gets scheduled and the tumor is removed. And hopefully the outcome would be better against the potential metastatic disease. So I think that the different types of therapies, the four different basic types of therapies I've talked about, clearly they're already being integrated with the three main types of surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation. And I think the fourth type now is going to be immunotherapy, which is already in a lot of clinics already. It's being done. And they have to be integrated together, so you have to have the timing right, and you have to get the details right. I think, as Dr. Leonard pointed out, the details are also going to matter of the molecular characteristics of the tumors and also the immune characteristics of the tumors. The mechanisms that a tumor uses to protect itself against the immune system also vary quite a bit, and so you need to be able to understand how this tumor is protecting itself and what's the best way to address that.
You've been doing research and testing on using plant virus particles to trigger this immune system reaction we've been talking about against tumors, and you've been doing it in mice. Dave says, I wonder if cancer research on mice is reliable enough to be justified. Many treatments that work for mice don't work for humans. So in looking at your work, how do you think this will translate into humans?
Well, I think that Dave's point is a very good point. I think that the reality is that we really don't have many different ways of learning about what will work and what won't work in an experimental situation other than mice. I'm also involved with some work that's being done with community dogs that develop their own tumors, and we're working on some experimental treatments with them. But in general, mice are the standard living model. I think we just have to live with that. I think that we have to learn what we can from the mice and then carefully bring things into the clinic, which is how it's done now, and test them first for safety and then for evidence of efficacy, and then have larger trials. I don't see a way that we're going to particularly make sure that every mouse experiment is going to turn out to be the same in humans. We do have a lot of capability to genetically modify mice, and I think that's enabling the models to get better. And so our ability to take what's learned in a mouse model and move it into humans, I think, is improving.
So do you, going back to our very first thought about this idea of a cancer moonshot and the president really highlighting treatment and prevention and research into cancer, do you think that that's a good idea?
Well, you're talking to a cancer researcher. So I expect you would, you know, not be surprised that I think it's a fabulous idea. I think that I think back on when I was a graduate student almost 30 years ago, and experiments that, you know, to get some piece of data that might take a week or 2 weeks to get information about one gene and how it's responding in some situation, now we can do them in a matter of days or hours and get information on many thousands of genes at once. And so our ability to gather information, our ability to do the research is, as most the listeners have often heard the idea about exponential growth, and it's just been doubling rapidly over the last 30 years. And it's, you know, for somebody who's sort of lived through this revolution, it's remarkable at the amount of data that we can generate and the detail that we can get to understand it. And so I feel like not only has the efforts in cancer paid off clinically, I feel like they've also paid off with tremendous understanding about basic biology that affects not only cancer but lots of other health situations. And it's been somewhat frustrating because over the last roughly 10 years, there's really been a limit on the amount of funding that's been going into biomedical research in general through the main sponsor of biomedical research is the National Institute of Health.
Well, it sounds like with the president's plan, maybe we will get some more federal funding. And I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're out of time for this today. But I really appreciate you telling us about your work and your work in cancer research. Thank you.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you, Jean.
Dr. Stephen Fiering is a professor of microbiology, immunology, and genetics at Dartmouth College's Geisel School of Medicine. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The last few years have made Americans more familiar with the stories of people who are transgendered. But the transgender community in Vermont points out that transgender people are living normal, everyday lives in this state while also still working to gain acceptance. In Worcester, Rachel Young wrote to tell us that the Transgender Day of Visibility is this week, and she plans to spend the day being an activist. I talked with Young via Skype this morning.
Transgender Day of Visibility is this Thursday. It's March 31st of every year since 2009. And the day came into being out of frustration that the only day set aside for transgender people was about those lost to us by murder or suicide. So the idea of Transgender Day of Visibility is to really remind people that transgender folks exist, that we are in your communities contributing. We're here. We're not going away. And we're your neighbors, your friends, public servants, your kids. We really just want to be more visible. Make sure that people don't forget we're here.
Well, given that, given the point of the day is to be able to share your stories, your triumphs, your sadnesses, your sort of regular life, tell me a little bit about your story and what you'd like to get out there.
Sure. Yeah, I'm 39. year-old stay-at-home mom. I'm married. I live in Worcester, Vermont. And I've been really lucky, I think, through my transition. I'm about 4 years into my transition. I've been married for 8 years. So my partner, Megan, has been with me through it all. I think a lot of people who transition will lose something. Sometimes friends or family will walk away. A lot of transgender folks lose employment. I have kept almost everything important to me. I've been super fortunate. So I try to take that seriously and pay it back a little bit by being more visible and more active and trying to get the word out on trans issues.
You said you started transitioning about 4 years ago. What was it that prompted you to decide, okay, now's the time, 4 years ago?
It was kind of the convergence of some mental and physical health issues that kind of came up out of nowhere for me and kind of led me just to decide that life is way too short not to live it genuinely.
How do you talk to your child? You have a daughter, right? You said you're a stay-at-home mom.
I do.
In terms of talking about visibility and talking about being a transgender woman, is that something that you discuss with your child?
Once in a while, we do. Charlotte is six, and that means I started my transition from dad to mom when she was two. She doesn't really have any memory of me as her dad. We have pictures around the house, like wedding pictures and things like that, and we're very open about it. But I find kids have a much easier time than a lot of adults with transgender folks. It's as simple as saying, I was born in a boy's body, and that was very uncomfortable for me. And so now I'm taking medicine to help my body better match the way I feel inside.
So in some ways, it's a simplistic explanation, but also the most true when you talk to a child.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'm on the school board here in Worcester, so I'm in the school all the time. And kids really never have any problems. I find that working with adults can be a little more challenging.
Well, talk a little bit about some of those challenges. I mean, when you wrote to us, you said that Worcester's a great place to live, and you sort of further qualified it by saying it's a really great place to be a transgender woman.
Yeah, it really is. And I think I was as surprised as anybody else to be out here in kind of the middle of nowhere, rural Vermont, and find that we had such a impressively diverse population. There's a lot of LGBT folks here. In fact, on Thursday, on the Transgender Day of Visibility, I will be sitting over in our post office parking lot being visible with another transgender resident of Worcester.
Just sitting there to be visible or doing anything specific?
You know, I'm not a yeller and a screamer, so we're going to have some signs and be available and open for anyone who might want to talk to us about trans issues or pretty much anything else. I think I'm a pretty well-known entity here in town at this point. So I don't expect anyone to respond super strongly to my presence. But I still think it's an important day to remind people that we're here in rural Vermont, because we really are everywhere.
Rachel, you mentioned that you think, by and large, compared to many other people who are transitioning or who are living their lives as transgendered people, you have had it lucky in some ways. But you also said that gives you a responsibility to be out there during the Day of Visibility and to share your story. What do you think your responsibility is in that realm?
Transgender folks face a lot of challenges in both in Vermont and nationally. Yeah, 41% of transgender people have attempted suicide, and that's compared with 20% of the rest of the LGBT population and less than 5% of the general population. There's a lot of things that contribute to that, and discrimination, like what we're seeing in North Carolina this week, is a big part of that. And I think visibility is the best way that we can address some of the triggers for folks who are struggling. Visibility and activism is a choice, but not an obligation. In many parts of the world, if a transgender person can fly below the radar socially, they're far more likely to see success in their careers, to be safe from assault or murder, to avoid being potentially arrested and sent to jail under these bathroom bills that are being talked about right now. The point is that a person doesn't need to be visible in order to be in favor of transgender rights. And for many people, it's much safer for them not to be out. That's not the case for me. I have a great life. I've been very fortunate in both accessing care and in keeping the people who are important to me. So I feel like maybe that's more my job than some of the people who have so much to lose.
You mentioned, Rachel, the North Carolina bill, and this is a bill that was passed by the state legislature on March 24th that blocks local governments from passing anti-discrimination rules that would grant protection to gay and transgender people. So what do you think about the overall climate for the rights of all kinds of people, but particularly transgender people?
I think we're taking really important and really good steps, and that we need to keep the pressure on, because bills like this are going to keep coming until there is pushback. You know, from where I sit here in Vermont, I think we're in a really good place. There's a lot of work left to do. But the pressure that these bills are up against, and we're already seeing it in North Carolina. And yesterday, the Georgia governor vetoed a similar bill because of the pressure that both business and residents of his state and of North Carolina are putting on him, lawmakers, to stop these things from happening.
Rachel Young lives in Worcester. You can go out and see her at the Worcester Post Office on Thursday. It is the National Transgender Day of Visibility. Rachel, thank you very much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you, Jane.
And are you okay with me sending all of our many thousands of VPR listeners to the Worcester Post Office on Thursday?
Oh, good God. Yeah, that's fine. I would be surprised if anyone showed up.
Again, the Transgender Day of Visibility is Thursday. We spoke with Rachel Young on Skype. That's it for today. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.